This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And after October 7th, every single one who stood up for Israel lost their brand partnerships.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is the founder of Barzel Media, a small boutique company that puts together, matches influencers that speak about and for Israel and the Jewish diaspora with brands that support them. So here I am with Brian Spivak.
Hello, Shai. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Yeah, it's good to be here.
We should say that you live in Israel, so you're just happening to pass through.
Happen to be here, yeah. I'm on a speaking tour going from New Jersey and New York to LA and Florida on a speaking tour, and so happen to be in New Jersey during this time.
And you grew up not far away from where we are.
Yeah, I grew up in Englewood. Yeah, we're pretty close by, so 10-minute drive, yeah.
Is this your first, second time since October 7th of being here?
Being back? Oh, no, I've been back a bunch of times. I actually came to produce, like, the coolest time I came back. Actually, I've done a lot of things, so I actually helped run a delegation at the Sundance Film Festival, like, 4 months after October 7th with hostage families, so that was really special. And then also produced this hockey game at UBS Arena. I don't know if you saw that. So been back to do some really, really cool events. So yeah, it's nice to come back. Yeah.
Where do you feel more comfortable? Tel Aviv?
Definitely Tel Aviv. Yeah. 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 When I said it's nice to be back, my heart is always in Tel Aviv and always in Israel. And it's like, no matter where I go, I'm so happy always to come back home to Israel. Mm-hmm. It's the best feeling. I could be on like the best vacation, like sailing around the world and like, always good to be back in Israel.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you happened to be here exactly when we're recording so we can make this happen.
Yeah.
And let's start with the first question I ask every guest. Brian Spivak, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, wow. Should have done my homework and checked out to see if that was the first question.
It's good that you did.
What kind of Jew? Yeah. It's more natural. Yeah.
Authentic Brian Spivak.
Exactly. That's how I like to show up. So what kind of Jew am I? I think I'm a passionate, unique Jew that you wouldn't necessarily be able to label me just by meeting me, reading me, looking at me. And people start to get to know and understand me after really getting to know me, what kind of Jew I am. And also, I think that I became definitely a different type of Jew after October 7th, like before October 7th. Never had anything to do with Jewish advocacy at all whatsoever. Didn't know like what the Jewish Federation was, right? I still don't know what they do. But I didn't know this stuff and I'm still navigating it. And so now that I'm in this world, I've become definitely a more passionate, like fiery, like proud stand up for Israel type of Jew.
All right. So we're going to dig into that journey and what happened. Yeah. But you said that you're a unique Jew, that you aren't necessarily the kind of Jew that people would understand just by looking at you. Mm-hmm. So for people that are not watching and are just listening, let me just describe you and then you tell me what are people missing. So you're wearing, let's go from your sneakers, you got really cool kicks, the Reebok, blue jeans, a shirt that says it's a big lion and it says Iron Lion Zion.
That's right, yeah. We could add Brian on there to make it rhyme too. Right. Yeah.
You know, a little bit like, you know, well-kept beard. Mm-hmm. You look like an American in Tel Aviv.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
So what are people missing just by looking at you?
Yeah, I think what people are missing is, and again, I do like people to get to know me first, but I keep Shabbat, I keep kosher, I'm a spiritual Jew. I've definitely had a journey into this like new phase of my exploring Judaism since I moved to Israel. One that I didn't feel really connected to prior to moving to Israel, like kind of just run of the mill, modern Orthodox Jew going with the flow. And I felt like just so much was missing. And I'm like, I feel like I'm missing something about Judaism. And it took me to actually get divorced and really start to rediscover myself, who I am, and what is my personal identity, that I also started exploring what Judaism really means to me and what elements am I really attached to. And it's not about how I look, but it's what I do, what I feel connected to, authentically connected to, as opposed to just going through the motions and looking a certain way. And so I think when people encounter me, they, you know, sometimes I wear a kippah, sometimes I don't. And so they might think that, oh, whatever, you know, he's this type of person. And the cool part is that in Tel Aviv, really, it's very difficult to put a label on anyone because you really don't know. And you have people show up for Friday night dinner or, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat at a shul, and yet they don't keep Shabbat, but they make sure to show up every single Kabbalat Shabbat. And it's, so I like that. I like that people feel connected to, this is the thing that I desire to do, so I'm going to do this thing. I don't need to do everything. No one needs to have a label on me. And so I love that element of, and I see that a lot in Tel Aviv specifically. And I feel like when people encounter me, it's kind of, they're like, oh, I guess I can do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, maybe like him a little bit.
It's interesting because a lot of people associate places like Tel Aviv, you know, it's a big metropolis, as almost like where you go to lose your Judaism or your Jewish identity.
Yeah.
And yet it seems like you've had a somewhat opposite experience.
Yeah.
Is that common, or do you, or is that the unique part that you said, I'm a unique?
It's a good question. I've definitely seen people really get attached to their Judaism in Tel Aviv. I think people find it. I think it's definitely easy to get lost. It depends what type of person you are. It depends how grounded you are. It depends if you are very intentional about what you're looking to do in life. I think what's really interesting is that I was looking for something. I was looking for a little bit more direction and meaning, and I was very intentional about it. And so I think that there are pockets of it. And I think what's also kind of unique is that you can, because it feels like nobody else is doing it, when you do it, it is special. And so when I go to Jerusalem, it just, I personally don't feel connected to the city as much. I don't feel connected to the Judaism there because it's like, you're just kind of like walking with the crowd and everyone else is doing it and you're going with the flow. And I feel like so much of my personal life and my outlook has actually been, when everyone else is doing X, why is it that everyone's doing this thing? And it's come up like very like politically, like there's like big movements. And I'm like, everyone's doing this thing, but I feel like there's something else there. And so I usually stop and take a look. Yeah, it's not necessarily connected to Judaism because Judaism is this collective thing, you know, religion that we are all part of.
But it's the way.
But it's the way. It's the way. And so I'm not necessarily always taking a look at it and saying like, I'm just going to go with the flow with what everyone else is doing. I stop, I analyze, I take a look and see what's really going on and what is the meaning behind everything that we're doing.
So when did you move to Israel?
11 years ago.
11 years ago.
Yeah.
So you spent 9 years in Israel before October 7th and the war. What did you do? What was your job? What was your life like?
Yeah, just normal, like American, living in Tel Aviv, working at a tech company, doing tech sales. Like, you know, I spent 5 years at a video animation company. You know, just regular person at a job. Yeah.
And then what happened on October 7th?
Yeah, so I would say right before October 7th, career-wise, I was working at a small stint, like, I don't know, maybe 6 months before October 7th, at an influencer marketing agency. So October 7th happened, and about...
Wait, before you get...
Sure, yeah.
What is an influencer marketing...
Yeah, an influencer marketing agency. I also didn't know prior to starting the job. So I was like, new to, like, all of a sudden, like, checking out this new industry, learning about it for the first time. It's an agency that works with brands to, or represents talent and helps them find partnerships, right? So if, you know, there's a sponsor maybe for this podcast, who knows, or maybe you guys are looking for a sponsor, or maybe I'm going to help you get a sponsor, you would do an intro and say, you know, this episode is sponsored by such and such brand, and you or the podcast would get paid to do that. So there's YouTube channels that make a lot of money. And so our company that I was working for was focused on YouTubers and finding them sponsorships, sometimes representing the brand, sometimes representing the talent.
I see. And, yeah. And then October 7th happens.
Then October 7th happens. And I was volunteering at different places after October 7th. And
we break that.
Oh, yeah, down. Sure. Right, sorry.
Like, yeah. Where were you when you first heard the news?
Yeah, so wake up 7 o'clock in the morning and I hear a siren. And I was like pretty new in my apartment. So I actually had no idea where my shelter was. I didn't have one in my apartment, that I knew for sure. But I didn't know where the nearest shelter was. And I didn't have one in my building, that I knew also. So I'm like, where do I go? And I was just like, all right, I'm just going to like chill here, whatever. And so siren stopped and then it was Simchat Torah. And so 3 hours later, 10 o'clock in the morning is when Chabad starts, like the shul that I go to. And so I was like, I was like startled and already like fired up and awake and there's no way I'm going back to sleep now. So I'm like, let me chill in my yard and just read. And in the distance, I'm just hearing lots of booms. And I'm like, okay, this is not as normal, but I've heard sirens
before. You're disconnected
before.
From your phone. You're disconnected
totally disconnected from,
news,
from my
right?
phone. No
so
idea what's happening.
Everything's happening in everything's the country, happening. Yep. But you're reading a book.
I'm reading a book and I'm like, okay, maybe something a little more than usual is happening, but nothing that alarmed me tremendously. And so I went to Chabad and walked there and showed up. And I immediately said to the rabbi, I was like, we need to make a security plan. I think we were about maybe 6 months or a year at this new shul. And so there's no shelter in the shul either. So he's like, okay, go ahead and, you know, figure out a plan. So I realized that there's a shelter across the street in the bottom of the apartment. And there's one also next door in the apartment next door. So we have like the men go out so that not everyone's going out one exit and it's closer. So we have men go out here, women go out here, start to have like a person responsible on the women's side to make sure that the women are getting out. And then I started to go upstairs to notify.
Yeah, let's pause for a second and take a moment to just realize how crazy that is that you're going to prayer.
Yeah.
And you need to figure out security plans.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anywhere else in the
no,
world.
But it also,
anywhere else in
the no, world. It definitely doesn't. And what's funny is that I did it because I was just like, oh, because there was a siren. Not because all of a sudden there was a war. I didn't know that. It was just, hey, there's a siren. If there's another one, what do we do? Right? Like, so, and I started to go upstairs to notify the women, the mothers who are like with their small children upstairs, what to do in case there's a siren. And as I'm explaining to them, a siren goes off. And so it's go time. And I start telling them where to go. And I start, you know, directing people and there's codes. And so we're able to use the codes because it's an emergency, on the doors of the apartment buildings that we're going into. And that was it. Like, you know, and since then I've actually been like responsible for security at Chabad, even though I never did the army. Like I moved to Israel too late. And it just was a role that I took on. Yeah.
Wow. So when did you find out what was really happening?
So slowly, you know, there are plenty of people who come to Chabad who don't keep Shabbat. And slowly we started to get reports from them saying like, this is something serious. There's been an infiltration. There are soldiers that have been killed already and like brutally attacked. And I made the mistake of like looking at somebody's phone. We started to realize that this was something serious. We started to hear something about hostages. Again, like slowly getting reports and a lot of unconfirmed reports. And It's funny, I remember somebody telling me, and Simchat Torah was a massively long day. Like you spend tons of time in the synagogue, just like dancing and drinking or whatever. And it was like a weird feeling, a weird environment in the synagogue. And I remember somebody telling me that a missile hit an apartment building in Tel Aviv. And I was like, I dismissed it. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you probably heard like a boom, and that was just like an interception. Like, missiles don't land in Tel Aviv. Like, this is where our Ministry of Defense is. Like, there's no way. And I was like that confident in it. And sure enough, yes, that morning a missile did hit Tel Aviv. And I felt like an idiot. But I was like, oh, this is serious. And I had this like false sense of protection that like, no, like we've got everything under control in Tel Aviv. And of course, you know, the Iran war since, and we know that that's obviously not really the case. Yeah.
So yeah, the first thing you started doing is volunteering.
Yes. Right. So October 8th, next day, there was a need for supplies for soldiers. So my friend and I, we went immediately to go to like the Shufersal, and supermarket, and we just bought supplies. We had like a list. This is what they need. And we bought supplies with our own money, and just then went to Dizengoff Square, where we were to deliver these supplies. Two significant things happened. One was, I remember the person in front of us was doing the same thing, and the woman behind the counter just like, she heard that, and she was just like, she said, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Like, she was just like so like taken aback by this act of selflessness that people were doing, that she just like felt compelled to say Shema Yisrael. And it was an unbelievable moment, and also not appearing religious at all. And then we went to Dizengoff Square, and at that point, I broke down. What I saw in front of me was like organized chaos. It was just people running around and packages, people packing boxes and like megaphones and like and organizing it. If you have this, come here. And it was just like organized chaos. And I was like, wow, we are at war. But then the other reason why I broke down was because the megaphones and seeing all these people here was 10 days before, or however long it was before. Dizengoff Square was the epicenter of the worst sinat chinam, the worst hatred of brothers, Jewish brothers. It's where the anti-religious were and like screaming and yelling at people who were praying publicly on Yom Kippur. And it broke my heart, like seeing that. It was like, it was the culmination, the real climax of the hate that we had and the division that was just killing our country. And then October 7th happened. And then I'm seeing that everyone coming together, it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like. And so the significance of that, the contrast of that also was very heavy.
Then you got involved with the hostage family forum.
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
it even became the forum, right? Right as it was becoming.
It was already kind of established. So about 3 weeks into the war, so I was volunteering at like hotels and other places, just helping out wherever I could, and also working my full-time job. And there were a lot of people, my company, who like really couldn't work. Like they were just so emotionally, like they couldn't. And so I was covering for a lot of people. And volunteering here, setting up concerts for people, like for families, for refugees. Like it was just crazy, just nonstop, of course. And everyone was doing that. Everyone was volunteering their time nonstop after October 7th. And so I got a phone call 3 weeks into the war from a friend of mine, somewhat new friend. And I was like, what's up? Like, where have you been? I haven't like heard from you since the start of the war. And he's like, I'm volunteering at the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. I'm like, what the heck is that? And he's like, that's where all the families of the hostages are. It's where we're advocating for them. And he was doing PR for them. And I was like, do they need any help? And he said, yeah, probably. I was like, is there anyone doing influencer marketing? This is like this new thing that I recently started doing. So maybe I can help. And he's like, sure, come. Like, here's the address. Come tomorrow. So I went the next day. it's kind of a crazy story, but I show up and it's like also like chaos, like just people running around. It's in an office building, people running around. There's just like families or people wearing t-shirts and media nonstop. And like the secretaries at the desk were just like answering phones left and right. And like it felt like a scene, like if you were to describe like a chaotic office scene from like the 90s, right? Like, hello, Mr. So-and-so's office, please hold. Like it was that, it was insane.
Because this was 3 weeks into the war.
3 weeks.
If I'm not mistaken, not all the hostages were known to, some were assumed to be dead. Like it was just unclear back then.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, unprecedented in so many
Which is
ways.
Why it was called the hostages and missing families for them, because there were so many people that were just missing and unaccounted for. They didn't know if they were taken hostage. Mm. And so, so I show up and I'm like, hey, I want to help in this area of influencer marketing. Is there a marketing team? And they're like, yeah, maybe wait for this person. They're like, I don't know where they are, but just like sit in the lobby. And I'm like, okay, I'll just sit in the lobby and like wait, I guess. And I'm like just observing, seeing all this like people running around, taking it all in. And then I hear someone say, Brian? I was like, hey, it was my former CMO from like a few companies before. And she's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, I'm here to help. And she's like, cool, come join my team. So join her marketing team and trying to get the lay of the land, what the strategy is, what they're trying to do. And great. Like first day was just taking information in. I show up the next day. Oh, I also like met Wolf Blitzer in the elevator, like randomly first day. And that was the first of many like really fascinating people that I started to meet. So I show up the next day because this is not a one-time thing. Show up the next day and the strangest thing, all of it was gone. No signs anymore. No secretaries. No posters. No families. I was like utterly confused. I was like, did we free the hostages? Like what's going, like, where is everything? It was like a scene from a movie where you're like telling your friend, like, I swear it was all here. There was a secretary. There was this, there was the band playing there. It was gone. I was like so confused. And then like somebody else, I think was in a similar situation. They're like texting somebody. Turns out they moved. That was the last day they were in that office. So the first day I showed up, that was the last day they were in that location. And since then they had moved to the checkpoint offices where they still are today.
Yeah. Which by the way is so emblematic of the chaos that was engulfing Israel.
Crazy.
So how long did you volunteer with the hostages and missing?
So I was there about 4 to 5 months. Yeah. So
what did you do with them?
So I built and ran the influencer program. So it turns out there was nobody really managing any influencer from the inside, like internally. And so I decided to build and run an entire influencer program. I ended up having a team of volunteers. So people would like contact me. They saw that I was doing this and they were like, can I help? And so people would come in and some people would last a couple of days, a week. You know, people wanted to get involved, but sometimes they always didn't have the capacity to really execute on those things. And so I had a team of anywhere from 4 to 5 volunteers on my team. And our aim was to have influencers and celebrities be a positive voice for the hostages and tell their individual story. The social media team was responsible for sharing a lot of the images and then the collective story. And it was a massive social media team. But our job was to tell the human story. Who is Omer? Who is Romy? What would they be doing right now if they weren't in captivity?
What was that like? I mean, it must have been such a difference from like what you were doing just a couple of months before, working with the same people, with influencers.
Yeah.
But on something completely different.
Yeah. Well, actually, the funny thing is that I came with zero Rolodex, no influencers. I didn't know anyone. My team of volunteers would often say to me like, Brian, do you know who so-and-so is? And I'm like, never heard of them. Like, no idea. Like when I was working at this influencer agency, it was YouTubers and I was working on the brand side or even like selling our software. So I had very little involvement with influencers. And if I did, they were YouTubers and like not connected to Israel at all. So I was like also kind of like learning everything too. I was learning about Instagram. I was fresh too. And I was just like, But it was also a period of time where it didn't matter what you did, what your background was. If you wanted to help and you were passionate, you could do anything, right? Like everyone became an arms dealer overnight, right? Mm-hmm. I've got helmets, I've got plates for the vest and this and that. So, you know, and it, and I used to give, fast forwarding a little bit, I would give tours to celebrities and just like walk them through the hostage forum and introduce them to different teams, how it works. And inevitably, I'd always ask somebody on the team, I'd be like, what were you doing before October 7th? Like, you know, I was a nurse. I'd be like, so what qualifies you to be on the international media team? No, it didn't
speak
matter.
Speak English.
Yeah, speak English. Yeah, exactly. Right. So it really didn't matter. It was if you were passionate enough and you were able to really just roll up your sleeves and get the job done. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think is a very Zionist mentality.
100%.
Right? It's not about, you know, think about like, 100 and some years ago, like you're in Europe, you don't know anything about farming, about, you know, animals, but you're like, I'm going to go to this place mm-hmm. and I'm going to start a kibbutz
yep.
and I'm going to learn how to do everything. And what you needed is passion and persistence.
Yep.
Right. And
yep.
and that's kind of the mentality of the here I am that we're trying to bring to the US, this mentality of find what you're good at and just be passionate about it and start moving.
It's really my story. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you do that for a few months, and then you pivot once again to start what you call an economic Iron Dome.
That's right, yeah.
Under Barzell Media.
That's right.
So we're going to get to Barzell Media in a second, but what is an economic Iron Dome, and what do we even need? What's the need here? What are you solving?
Yeah. So basically, one of the things that I was noticing is when I was running these campaigns with influencers, is that anybody who was standing up for Israel and the hostages, every single one of them was losing their brand partnerships without exception. So let's break that down for a second, what that means. If you're a content creator, meaning your sole job in life is to create content on social media, the way you make money is through paid brand partnerships. That's it. Like, maybe if you're on YouTube, then you are making revenue from YouTube AdSense, like they'll pay you. But really the main way that people make money online as a content creator is through partnerships. And after October 7th, every single one who stood up for Israel lost their brand partnerships. Some of them lost tens of thousands of dollars. Some of them lost hundreds of thousands. Some people lost their entire careers overnight, and some have still yet to recover.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is for speaking about the hostages.
The hostages. Yep. The hostages.
Okay, so before we get to the solution, so mm-hmm. this is the problem. Walk me through the mind of the brand manager in whatever company. Mm-hmm. They see an influencer talking about civilians taken from their home. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they decide, let's drop this person as an ambassador for a brand. Why? What's the logic there?
Yeah. So I'll give one answer, and then there's another speculative answer. So one aspect of it, if I'm being just brutally candid, after October 7th, Israel, Hamas, the war became such a topic of division. And it was creating so much hate and anger that if you're a brand, you kind of don't want that association. You don't want all of a sudden somebody who posted about it to be necessarily then talking about your brand and receiving all this hate and vitriol from that. So I think a part of it is an associative element of we don't want to be political, even though talking about hostages, like how is that political? But the unfortunate part is that it became political. That's one aspect that I think definitely existed.
Yeah. So you're basically saying, you know, if you're an influencer, you're talking, you know, typically you talk about skincare. Now you're talking about the hostages, you're getting hate. That hate would then translate to you talking about skincare, and the skincare company would say, we don't want people to come and say,
exactly,
die, you dirty Jew,
exactly,
when you're just talking about skincare.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So it was a big, big risk. But there's also a massive side of it where people where it was coming from hate too, where people did not want to be associated with Israel in any way. And there was just this massive wave of hatred against Israel. And so I don't know which ones were which, I actually do know certain circumstances where it was done out of real, like, just anti-Semitism and, like, hatred against Israel versus, like, caving into pressure and not wanting to be associated with something political, quote unquote.
Right. So you really laid out well the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, where people, and I gladly or not gladly, I don't know, would say, I'm not one of them. I don't make a cent from my social media.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are people that, you know, really rely on their social media partnerships to make a living. All of a sudden, just because they were taking a stand, and it's not like they haven't taken a stand before about Ukraine and Russia or other things, but because they were taking a stand about the Israel-Hamas war, about the hostages, they were being dropped.
Correct.
And that's the problem. So what is economic Iron Dome? What's the solution?
So what I saw was not just a problem of like, oh, okay, people are losing their brand partnerships. But I saw this as like a massive existential crisis for Israel's PR war. If we really break it down, if we think about it, somebody who's considering standing up for Israel, meaning they post about fitness or beauty, whatever the case might be, most of the time, and they're considering standing up for Israel, but when they do, they lose their income. How is that sustainable? Maybe that can last for a few weeks, a few months, but Israel needs people like them to post on their behalf when something big and important happens. And I was like, this is not sustainable. And nobody was talking about it. Everyone was talking about charity and how we need to do this and give to this. Nobody was looking at this from the economic perspective. And I happened to have come to the table with already having worked in this industry of like, well, I think I have an obvious solution. And so this is why I thought of creating an agency and helping pro-Israel influencers find paid brand partnerships. And originally I was like, oh, I'll just maybe do this at the Hostage Forum. Like, I'll just create like a little sub agency within it and I'll try and find it. And it was just so complicated to do. And then I was like, okay, I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't have any money. I don't, I've never built an agency before. I've been working in influencer marketing for 6 months plus 2 months doing, you know, advocating for the hostages. Like, what qualifications do I have? So I started shopping around the idea to other people. And they're like, it's a great idea, but I'm doing this, or I don't have the time or capacity. So I said, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? And that was what prompted me to start the agency. It was a crazy time. And I did it with $6,000 in my bank account. Stupid, like really dumb. Yeah. Financially.
And so that is the origin story of Barzel Media. Mm-hmm. Barzel translates to iron.
Iron, exactly.
So iron media, Barzel media.
Yeah.
So how does it work?
How does it work?
What what you wake up in the morning, or you know, there's a funny video of you come on a day of work with me on Barzel Media.
Yeah.
And you're sitting at a hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
But I noticed that the clock says like 1:35
Oh yeah!
PM. I was like, "Well, wow. You come in the in
you got an eye."
Yeah. what do you do?
What do we do exactly? So of course that was filmed. Yeah, as if we were trying to pretend that it was the morning. Yeah. So, but good eye. Wow, you're detail oriented guy. So what do we do? So we generally what we do is we find brands that are looking to do influencer marketing that are naturally pro-Israel, okay? That could be an Israeli charity. It can be a brand that is Israeli. It can be a brand that is owned by a Jew. It could be also just like an allied brand, right? Like maybe it's a Christian who loves Israel and is happy to work with us. Anybody who's happy to work with me, I'll work with them on the brand side of things, right? So any type of for-profit or nonprofit brand that wants to get exposure on the internet, we help them do that. And the way we do that is we'll manage a budget, right? So they'll say, great, we want to spend $20,000 on influencer marketing, and we will find them the right influencers that will meet their target audience, get their message across appropriately, and we manage the whole campaign for them from A to Z.
And how do you match the right brand to the right influencer, or maybe the right influencer to the right brand?
So it's,
I don't know. Maybe there's no need for matching.
Definitely you need to find the right ones for sure. Absolutely. So, we have a database of influencers who have stood up for Israel. I had a nice Rolodex from my time at the Hostage Forum. And so we are taking anyone who we've seen stand up for Israel. And we've categorized them too, right? So we have people in beauty category, of people who are just in, like, I put them in Jewish Israel category, right? Like, they're Hasbara creators, most likely. So, and so we have folks in every single type of category. And so we'll present these influencers to the brand and say, how do these look? Are they good? Do you like them? Yes, but, you know, maybe the price is too high. Maybe we can get it lowered. Why are they so expensive? We actually worked with them in the past and they actually perform really well. So we really recommend them. So there's all these different types of factors and details that go into how we end up closing one influencer with a brand and then just filling up that entire budget.
Now, you and I have had this conversation before, and I think it's an important conversation to have, regardless of where you stand on the topic. But, you know, we're talking about people who have decided to, despite, you know, losing money, or regardless of losing money, standing for what they believe in, the hostages, the victims, the against the war, whatever it is, like, people speaking up. Pairing them up with brands, helping them monetize their voice, doesn't it taint the good that they're doing? They come from a place of genuine authenticity, and now all of a sudden they're getting money.
So I think that it can taint if it is changing their value system, or if it is influencing their value system. I think influencers and content creators are authentic because no matter what they're doing, their value system is not changing, right? So if, for example, I haven't seen this, but if, for example, some company approaches, you know, these Hasbara creators, maybe it's a Christian organization, right? And says, hey, we want you to promote, we want you to promote a Christian cause or something, right? And if that's not something that they believe in, then that'll come across as inauthentic. Now, if it's something where they are still able to talk about what they normally talk about, maybe they talk about matchmaking, maybe they talk about being a Jew in the diaspora, right? Maybe that's their daily content. And then somebody comes to them and says, hey, we'd like you to promote this, an event, or we'd like you to promote, maybe a new Jewish book that's coming out, right? That's something that they would be promoting because it fits within their value system. And hopefully they like the book too, right? That's always a question. But it doesn't come across as inauthentic because it still fits within their value system. It's a Jewish book, and I talk about Judaism all the time. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Right. Yeah. So you kind of, like, we're talking about the ideas here, but who are your first customers and like, or some good influencer brand matching that you've been able to really help someone who lost, you know, their income, or maybe someone who wanted to get in the game and now they can do it much better? Are you at liberty to talk about?
Yeah, no, yeah. I can definitely. I mean, it's all, like, on our Instagram, so you can see it at Barzell Media. Actually, the first organization that hired us was actually the Hostage Forum. So they hired us back, right? So that was kind of cool. They're like, listen, we see what you're doing and we want you to work with these influencers. Now, the Hostage Forum never paid influencers to post. Like, we never paid any influencer to post. But we still needed to manage that whole process. And it's very, very intensive, very time consuming. And there's a lot of tracking. And so this is one of the early clients that we had. But we've worked with Frey Skincare. They're an Israeli skincare company that did not shy away from showing that they were Israeli and Jewish. And they said, you know, any influencer who wants to say that can talk about that, can say, this is an Israeli company and we're proud to represent them. They didn't have to if they didn't want to, but they were so passionate about standing up for Israel and being proud Israelis that they were okay with influencers talking about that. So that was really, really cool to see. And I got brand partnerships for people who never got brand partnerships before, who were kind of like in the crossover of like maybe Hasbara, but they like people would maybe watch them because they were, you know, doing some beauty elements. So there was like a lot of crossover sometimes, or sometimes there's strict beauty and or lifestyle influencers that happen to be pro-Israel. And it's a beautiful thing to actually like really find an Israeli brand that they could promote.
Mm, that's nice.
Yeah.
So who is your, like your, what would be your ideal person, influencer to work with? And what would be your ideal brand to work with?
I would say, it's hard for me to say ideal influencer. I haven't really thought about that, to be honest. I mean, I don't know. We could say like Gal Gadot, right? Like a superstar, right? Like, or Shai Davidai.
Shai Davidai and Gal Gadot, same sentence.
Yeah, keep that going. Exactly. We're going to get there. We're going to make it happen. I think more of brands. And I think one of the target brands that I had in mind that I was like, I would love to work with, SodaStream, right? Like SodaStream has everything that we want, which is it's a consumer product, which makes it a very natural fit to do influencer marketing for. It is an Israeli company. They promoted inclusivity. Like they had like a beautiful story about the fact that they integrate both Palestinians and Israelis working together. The problem is, or the challenge is that it's owned by a massive corporation. It's owned by Pepsi. And so it's not so simple to do these types of things anymore. But SodaStream, if you're watching, let's work together.
Contact us.
Yeah, contact us. Yeah, yeah.
And is there any, not specific people, but any red lines and influencers you wouldn't work with or brands you wouldn't work with?
So influencers, what I would say is although we're known for, you know, working with anyone that's pro-Israel, we are also kind of expanding into doing things that are just pro-Western values. And anything that is anti, you know, Islamic jihad, right? Like anything that is against that, though, this takeover that we're seeing from the West, this takeover that we're seeing of the West.
And it is sometimes from the West. Right,
sometimes it's front, right? It's from the West inside, and it's just this indoctrination that we're seeing, as you saw in Colombia. And so any time that we're able to push back against that in some capacity, and we have somebody that's standing up for Western values, we'll work with them because we believe that pro-Western values is the same, or if you're pro-Western values, you should be pro-Israel. And if you're pro-Israel, you're also definitely most likely pro-Western values. So there's a synergy there. There's a connection between those two things. And we've actually worked on campaigns that had technically nothing really to do with Israel. We worked on an awareness campaign to help the Druze, bring awareness to the Druze that were being massacred in Syria.
Right.
So does that help us? Not really, but it, and we found all different types of people to actually promote that.
I think it helps us indirectly. Right?
Indirectly, like,
and
for
it,
sure.
And
yeah.
It fits with our values.
Exactly.
Of speaking up for not just Jews, but for everyone.
Exactly.
You know, so I do think there's a big synergy there as well, right?
Yeah.
Is there any brand you like? I would never.
I would say it's you. The brand should likely say, I wouldn't want to work with you because of what you stand for, right? Because of what your agency stands for. So the fact that if a brand wants to work with me, they understand our values and they understand that they're going to be hiring pro-Israel influencers, right? So like, it would be weird if I had to reject them, right? But I don't know, nothing that's coming to mind right now because again, they would reject me first.
Right.
Yeah. And I would be happy to take their money and give it to pro-Israel influencers. That would be amazing, right? Like, so I would be winning if I would say, you know what? I thought you were actually against us, but now clearly I'm taking your money and helping the cause. So yeah,
that's a nice, yeah. Like that. And that's not the only thing you do. So you do multiple stuff, and you kind of mentioned that, you brought to life a hockey game,
yeah,
between, and I'll take a beat just for people,
yeah,
to
go.
Like,
yeah. Gonna,
if you're driving, maybe you want to stop for a second, between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Now, there's no ice in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but Jerusalem's team was playing Tel Aviv's team in Long Island.
Yeah.
How did you get involved? What's the story there, other than the fact that you're a hockey fan?
Yeah, yeah. So I am a hockey fan. And although hockey doesn't exist in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, there is hockey in Israel. There is ice hockey in Israel. There's multiple rinks. When I first made Aliyah, well, the funny story is that I grew up playing roller hockey my whole life. And then when I made Aliyah, moved to the desert, the Middle East, that's when I switched to ice hockey. Naturally. Makes sense. Yeah. And
you
so,
did say you're going against the grain.
That's true. That's so, true. Yeah. Oh my God. I never thought about it like that too. Yeah. So I started playing ice hockey in Israel. I played in Cholon, and then they opened up a rink in near Netanya, and then they opened up a rink. Oh, and we also played all the way up north in Metula, every once in a while. And yeah, there's like organized leagues, like proper serious hockey, like some really good hockey players. And in fact, actually, breaking news, this week, the first Israeli-born NHL hockey player scored a goal. First time ever an Israeli national has scored a goal in the NHL.
Shout out. What's his name?
Ziv Boim on the Minnesota Wild. Yeah, yeah. Right. So big shout out. Congrats, Ziv. Yeah.
Okay.
So ice hockey is it's really growing in Israel. And a buddy of mine started like a league where he would bring players in from all over the world and in Israel for a summer league, which is a time when a lot of hockey players have off, but they want to continue playing hockey. So he created a league called the Israel Elite Hockey League. And during the summer, they would play this tournament. And he's been doing it now for 5 years. And he calls me up one day and he says, "Brian, I have this crazy idea. Let me know if you want to get involved." And he says, "We want to do a hockey game at an NHL arena." And I was like, "Tal, you're crazy. But if anyone could pull it off, it's this guy, Tal." And I was like, "You're crazy, but like, sure, like count me in. Like, how can I help? How can I get involved?" And so first it was like, maybe we'd get influencers to promote the game. Maybe we'd get brands involved. And so I actually got brands on board to as sponsors. We had like a VC firm. We had Nefesh B'Nefesh. We had Leket as a sponsor, and we had like local eateries as well in New York as sponsors. And we brought Jerusalem versus Tel Aviv to play at UBS Arena. And at first I was like involved in like, okay, like brand partnerships, this, trying to maximize revenue for the opportunity for the game. And all of a sudden, Tal actually couldn't make it to the game. And I was like last minute scrambling to do logistics before the game and during the game. I was like helping to literally produce the game. I went up to the control center to help on the production of the in-game arena production. And then there's also the broadcast production. It was being live streamed on YouTube. And we had Kenny Albert, who's a world famous broadcaster, do the color commentary. Like, if you hear this guy's voice, you'd recognize his voice. Like he does every sport. Incredible. Like this was an NHL style production. And we had Jerusalem play against Tel Aviv in front of 8,500 fans. It was one of the greatest nights of my entire life.
You know, what's amazing to me is that, you know, and this is a theme that keeps going of almost every guest that we have. If someone just listened to this and didn't listen to the first 45 minutes of our conversation, you'd be like, "Whoa, this guy's probably an amazing, you know, CEO." And you are amazing. I'm not saying that. But like the CEO has been around the block multiple times. But no, you just like something. You believe in yourself. You do have the skills. You're not going in blind. And you just go for it. And I think that's a really strong and important mentality.
Thank you. Yeah. What's crazy is that I do say that I, like, in my head, I'm like, I've never done anything like this. Also, I didn't sign up to do all those other things. It's just, it was born out of necessity. It was just like, okay, there's nobody else doing it. I have to fill this role. And I'm not a logistics person. I'm not an event planner. Like, I've always said I'm like bad at that. And here I am literally doing that thing. It's insane. It was crazy. We even had an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor come out and bring out the Jerusalem team on the ice, skate in full gear equipment, not during the game, but he brought them out on the ice for like the opening ceremony. And what's funny was we were like trying to plan the logistics before, like, you know, I'm speaking to him and he was like so excited to do that. And I was like, I spoke to the other one of the partners in the league, and he's like, okay, we got to get permission from UBS Arena. Got permission from UBS Arena. He's like, okay, but like, what happens if he falls? And I'm like, we had done a practice like the Friday before, and I saw that he was able to skate. Like, I was like, he was fine in practice, whatever. He's not going to fall. He'll be fine. Comes out and I give him instructions on exactly what to do. And I'm like, just go around a half circle and then come back to me. And that's it, right? Because there are also carpets that come out on the ice during the ceremony. And he just went around and he almost fell on the carpets. But then he did fall. He fell on the ice in front of all the fans. And it was like, my heart stopped for a moment. I was like, oh no. And then people came to like try and help him. And he got up on his own accord. And the entire arena is just like clapping. Wow. And it was like this moment of like, that could have been terrible, was just like this moment of triumph too. It was beautiful.
Amazing.
Yeah. Like, and it was an incredible game. It went to overtime. It was like 7-6 in overtime. It was insane. Yeah.
All right. You've heard it here first. Yeah. Israeli hockey.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You're here in the US on a First of all, I hope many speaking tours, and you publicized the speaking tour. I want to take a quote from the video you made. It said, the next stage in anti-Semitism is that we're coming after our businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the problem that you're identifying there, and what is the solution? You're traveling around the country and telling people.
Yeah. So I'll give you the kind of the Cliff Notes version of it. But basically, anti-Semitism has many different phases. And it kind of goes where they're discriminating against us, they're harassing us, they're attacking us, they're looting us, they're blaming us for everything, they're killing us in the streets. And these are all things that we are seeing right now happening. And one of the next phases that happens throughout history is that they come for our businesses. And as soon as I say that, people start to be like, oh, right. Yeah, like that's true. And then they're like, oh, right. Yeah, because there was that guy who was the famous chef and he opened up a bunch of restaurants and now he has to close it down. Or there was that falafel shop that, you know, had the brick thrown through it. And, you know, there was this other boycott that happened. And then people are like, I'm fine. Like, I don't have like
it's
a restaurant.
Happen.
It's not gonna happen to me because I don't have a restaurant that's like visible that people can just spontaneously throw a brick through. So I'm fine. I have a real estate company. I have a manufacturing company. I have this, I have that. And it's like, no, commerce is global. Back in the day, everything was like visible. Like all the transactions were done right in front of you. Commerce is global now. And what happens if your biggest supplier comes to you and he supplies you with either 100% of this particular product or element that is critical to your business? Now, it works right now because it's a mutually beneficial commercial relationship. But the thing about anti-Semitism is that it defies logic, it defies money, it defies everything. And what happens if tomorrow he says, you know what, I don't want to work with you anymore. I'm canceling this relationship. I don't care that you've paid me $10 million a year. That's it. We're done. And maybe he's doing it because he's anti-Semitic and anti-Semitism becomes so mainstream. And that's how it has evolved over time. Like when it gets really strong, it becomes this mainstream way of thinking. So maybe he's anti-Semitic or maybe he caves into the pressure. And so one of the things that I one of the pieces of advice that I give to companies.
And we should say the pressure is maybe he has a 10 million contract with you, but he has a 100 million contract with someone else who's pressuring him.
Correct.
Or a public pressure campaign or whatever.
Correct.
The BDS.
Exactly. Correct. Good clarification. So my message to folks is, do you remember this campaign that we had that was going around on social media, which was like when Jews were being like viciously attacked in the streets? Like, will you hide me? Remember that? Mm-hmm. So I want people to do a kind of like a will you hide me calculation. This company or these companies that you so heavily rely on, when things get really bad, when shit hits the fan, can we say shit? Yeah.
Say
yes.
You
okay,
want.
Great. When shit hits the fan, right? Will you be there for me? Will you have my back? Or will you cave into pressure? And that is a serious thought that we need to be having that we're not having. And so one of the solutions that I mention is diversification, right? So if you have two suppliers, if you have one supplier and that supplier is maybe in the UAE, right? Now the UAE, they're an Abraham Accord member, right? So everything's fine, but they still deal in the Arab world, right? Tomorrow they could get pressure from their partners and say, sorry, like you can't work with them anymore. What will happen to your business overnight? So it's diversify, find a supplier so that when you do get that phone call, you could say, you know, problem, it might take me a couple of weeks to recover, maybe a month, but I'll be fine. I'll just give more business to this guy over here to, you know, Shlomo who lives in Guatemala or whatever it is, or maybe he lives in Florida, whatever, diversification. So that's one of the recommendations. And we specifically also offer diversification. Barzal Media offers diversification when it comes to media spend. Right. So we can talk about that also. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a
lot.
What's been the reaction when you tell people about
So I haven't given my speech yet. Mm-hmm. Tonight is my first.
Englewood, New Jersey.
Yeah, Englewood, New Jersey. People, as soon as I tell them the topic of my speech, people are and like really start to break it down. They're like, wow. Like, and they're like, why is nobody talking about this?
And you're like,
I am. Yeah. Here I am. Yeah. So, and it's actually like one of the lines that somebody said, it could have been my mom said to me, like, why is nobody talking about this? And many people have said this to me. And so I put in like the flyer, I wrote the most important topic that nobody's talking about. So that's on the flyer. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I hope a lot of people will pay attention and listen. Yeah. And that you'll come back again and again to the U.S. whenever you can.
I hope so too, yeah.
And we'll have you back again.
Amazing,
We're going to end with the Here I Am lightning round.
Okay, all right.
So rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just whatever comes to mind first. Brian Spivak, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Wow. So much. Like so much. It's hard to say one thing, that I used to hate public speaking. There we go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You come?
I made a New Year's resolution, a Rosh Hashanah New Year's resolution about 6 years ago, which was say yes to things that make you uncomfortable, but are objectively good. And I started telling people that I was doing that as well. So I had some level of accountability. So, and people started asking me things to do things and I just said yes. And the first time that happened was my CMO said to me at like one of the companies I was working for, she's like, you know, we're going to this conference, you're coming and we have a speaking slot. We'd like you to speak. Are you okay with that? And I said, yes. In my head, I'm like, what? Are you crazy? Like, what are you doing? And that's really been responsible for so much of my growth.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're just awesome. Like we're just great, unique, diverse people. And we're just friendly and cool. And we're not just, we don't come in one shape or size. Yeah.
What is your favorite curse?
My favorite curse?
English or Hebrew or whatever.
Wow.
Our language is.
My favorite curse? I've never thought about that. My favorite curse. So I guess we can curse. Yeah.
like stubbing your toe middle of the night.
I think Fuck. Yeah. I don't know. Fuck. I guess so. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
When was the last time you cried?
Oh, today. Today, when I was practicing my speech and I was either watching videos that I'm going to be presenting or even talking about certain things and talking about October 7th. There's one video that every single time I watched this video, without fail, I cried. And it is one of the campaigns that I ran when I was running the influencer program. This was called Recipes for a Turn. And we got influencers, food influencers, to create recipes in tribute to the hostages based upon food that the hostages like to eat or cook. And Sivan's Kitchen, who's like a very famous food blogger, created a video for Evyatar David, who we can now finally say is home. And every time I watch this video, I would cry. It was just so well done. And today I watched the video and I just, yeah, again, broke down and cried. Yeah.
Yeah. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Wow. Oh my God. I really don't know. Oh my gosh. Such a hard question. Can we come back to that? Yeah, I don't have an answer. Yeah.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Favorite Jewish holiday? I think Simchat Torah. I think it also has so much significance now. I mean, it went from being this beautiful, amazing holiday to the Black Sabbath and, you know, terrible day that it was on October 7th. And then the year in between, last year, 1 year ago, it was also super confusing because how do you celebrate, how do you be happy when there are hostages in captivity? And unfortunately, the anti-religious groups were like very, like we were doing Hakafot Shniot, which is like the second round of Hakafot, right after Simchat Torah last year, and we were met with a lot of hate from them in Dizengoff Square. We were just dancing with the Torah. How can you be dancing with their hostages? It was a terrible experience. It was one of the worst feelings I've had in a long, long time. And the sad part is that the whole point of Hakafot Shniot is it started because we knew that our brothers and sisters in Poland in the 1930s and 40s were not able to dance. They were not able to celebrate the Chag. And so we were dancing in their merit. And so, and now that the hostages have been freed, Simchat Torah has, like right before Simchat Torah, is unbelievable. Right before the holiday, we were able to like celebrate. So it's been this roller coaster of experience, this holiday. Wow. Insane, yeah.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
It used to be Yom Kippur, and actually Yom Kippur has now become one of my favorites in Tel Aviv. It's just like, which is crazy. Like it's insane. Who would think that they would love Yom Kippur, but it's become, I mean, I could spend like 20 minutes on Yom Kippur in Tel Aviv and why I love it. I would say my least favorite is probably Tisha B'Av. You know, it's not a holiday. Yeah. It's like the worst day in Jewish history. Yeah.
When do you feel safest?
In Tel Aviv. Like when I'm just anywhere in Tel Aviv, I feel safest. Yeah.
When do you feel least safe?
It's a feeling that I don't know. I don't remember last time I didn't feel safe. I really try not to like have any fear that just like enters me. Like I try and just stand strong, like wherever I am. And I know that if I can just push away any fear, not out of like, I'm not paying attention to it, but like knowing that fear is not serving me, then it just helps me be who I am. And it helps me show up with such strength.
What gives you hope?
There's so much that gives me hope. I think there's so many beautiful moments. A lot of it comes back to Tel Aviv because I really see so much hope when I'm in Tel Aviv. I see people come together from all walks of life. I see people who have no connection, or you don't see them as having any connection to their like spiritual side, and they're like, they're yearning for it. And we're like, where'd that come from? It's like, well, you just needed to like open the door a little bit. And again, it doesn't mean that they're becoming religious, right? But they're like seeking this, and they're seeking this connection, and there's no judgment from the person that they're seeking it to or from. And it's beautiful. And I think also I see a lot of hope in this new peace deal. Like I think that it took somebody as crazy as Trump. And when they describe him, they're like, nobody else could have done it because he's so crazy, because he's so unconventional. And I think when you're addressing the Middle East, you cannot come with any conventional way. You just can't.
Here's to craziness.
Yeah.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
There is an organization. Well, there's a lot. I'm going to get in trouble for saying one versus the other because I represent a few organizations. So I'm going to name a few. Leket Yisrael is a great organization.
L-E-K-E-T.
L-E-K-E-T, yep. Great organization, but we've started to work with in the last several months an organization called Beit Binyamin, which is helping soldiers and families of soldiers and really anybody affected from October 7th heal, but heal in unique ways. It's basically a retreat center in Tzfat where you can just get away from all the craziness, from all the intensity, and really relax, get therapy, go to a spa, and just really step away. And so it's in honor of Benjamin Early, who fell in battle shortly after October 7th. And his parents owned this piece of property in Tzfat, and it was an investment for them. And they turned it into a retreat center and a nonprofit to help people affected from October 7th. I mean, what's more beautiful than that?
So it's Beit
Binyamin, yeah, so donate.
How do you
B-E-I-T and then binyamin.org, I think, is the website. Yeah.
Brian, where can people find you? Where can they find Barzel Media?
Yeah, so I'm most active on Instagram. So at barzel.media, and then you can just look up Brian.
Let me spell that for people. BARZEL.media.
Yep. And also my personal account. Just look up Brian. I'm usually one of the first Brians that shows up. I'm like the only Brian in Tel Aviv. We're going to have comments from people, from Brian's in Tel Aviv.
We're going to start a Brian community in Tel Aviv.
And also on LinkedIn, you know. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Honestly, I really hope that you're absolutely wrong. And all
I
the
hope
problems
so
that you have pointed to will be proven, you know, not that problematic.
Yeah. By the way, I do say that even if I'm wrong, that there's so much... the byproducts of it are still very good.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, which brings me to the next point, which is I hope you're extremely successful in your economic Iron Dome.
Thank you.
And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Brian Spivak.
Thank you so much, Shai. I appreciate it. You're the man.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."